That? Okay. Good morning, everyone. Well, as you can see, I'm not here at this moment. I'm in New York at a meeting that will be later on today. And I felt a good alternative would be for me to record this lecture ahead of time. I've never done this before, and it's kind of strange to be giving a lecture speaking into a video camera rather than to an audience. But we'll see how it goes. I hope this will be a reasonable substitute for my physical presence. So today's topic is consumerism. We've touched on this a little bit in the very first lecture when I was saying what kind of society we were and described the kind of capitalism we live in. Consumerism was one of the features of capitalism. And in the discussion of the environment last week, consumerism was one of the sources for environmental problems that we encounter in the world today. But today I want to hone in on this idea itself, consumerism. Consumerism. Well, let's begin with a definition. That's always a good place to start. What is consumerism? So here's the definition on the slide. Consumerism is the belief that personal well-being, happiness, and status depend largely on the level of personal consumption, particularly the acquisition of material goods. Hyper-consumerism, hyper means an extreme form of whatever it is you're talking about. Hyper-consumerism then is the frenetic pursuit of consumer goods. A consumerist society, then, is a society in which a great deal of time and energy and resources and values are devoted to consuming. The general view of things in a consumerist society is that consumption is good. More is better. It's a bit like happiness. You really can't have too much of it. You know, for happiness, it's a little hard to say, gosh, you're just too happy. Happiness is something which basically you want as much as possible. Well, consumerism begins to have that sort of flavor to it. Consumption is good. Perhaps the best example of consumerism and how it figures in American society, or at least a good example to give you a point of departure for this discussion, is the issue of the growth of home sizes in the United States in recent decades. So this is the graph that's on the board right now. What this graph shows is the median size of new home construction in the United States from 1963 to 2007. Median means the size of the house that's right in the middle of the distribution of all house sizes. So in 1963, the average new home that was built in the United States was 1,400 square feet. 1,400 square feet. That increased a bit, then dropped a bit, up and down, until the early 1980s. In 1984, it was still only 1,600 square feet. But then look what happened. It climbed steadily until today, the median house size is over 2,200 square feet. This is another kind of picture of the same sort of thing. This is looking at the distribution, what percentage of new houses are really big, over 2,400 square feet, or quite small, under 1,200 square feet. There was a time, not that long ago, 1973, in which 25% of all houses were under 1,200 square feet, and only a little over 10% of new homes constructions were 2,400 square feet. Now there's almost no houses built as small as 1,200 square feet, whereas almost 50% are over 2,400 square feet. Now that's a huge increase, a huge shift in how people think of what a proper home is. A proper home used to be more like what we now would think of as a small cottage, whereas now a proper home is sometimes caricatured as a McMansion, a really large, spacious house. The ironic thing in a way about this has gone along with the family size is declining. So if you actually looked at the number of square feet per person in a house, that's expanded even more dramatically than the size of the houses themselves. Now, of course, if you have a really big house, you have to buy a lot of furniture to fill it with. I mean, imagine having a 60-inch flat-screen television in a 1,200-square-foot house. No, if you want to have giant televisions, you need big rooms in which to put. So once you get a big house, you do a lot of shopping to fill it up with stuff. Big houses, lots of stuff. That's a symptom of consumerism. We've had huge growth of productivity in the United States over the last 40 years. One of the effects is not that we have more time available to live our lives free of obligation in small and modest houses. No, we keep working very hard so that we can afford to buy giant houses and fill them with lots of stuff. Well, is this a problem? Is this a problem? What is wrong with consumerism? It often sounds pretty elitist. You know, some snotty academic, an elitist says, you're consuming too much. I know what's good for you. You're spending too much time shopping. You know, it sounds like this is a elitist person who is telling other people what's good for them. What's bad about consumerism? It's just a way of life. There's many different ways of life. Some people like to shop. Some people like to go for hikes in the woods. Shopping, hikes in the woods, these are just tastes, just preferences. Is there anything really wrong with consumerism? That question that makes it seem like it's even wrong to question consumerism, to say that this is somehow a bad way of life, that there's something wrong with these preferences, this is particularly that criticism of the critics of consumerism is something that comes along with the free market paradigm. Markets are supposed to properly register people's preferences. And if people have preferences for consumption over other ways of life, that's just the way it is. People should be free to follow their own heart. And if following your heart is the frenetic pursuit of stuff, well, so be it. That's just one way of life among many. So what's wrong with consumerism? Why would one ever think that in American society we over-consume and that this is a problem, something we should worry about? There are three big issues which we'll discuss around this issue. Three reasons why I think it is indeed a problem. First, there are really big negative externalities from consumerism. Your choice to be a hyper-consumerist has consequences for other people, not just for you. Now, when you have spillover effects like that, when making a choice just because it's your preference has consequences for the lives of others, and consequences which may be harmful for the lives of others, well, it's at least then something to think about. At least it means there's something to worry about. Even if you decide in the end, that's just the way things are. There are trade-offs, maybe not so bad. That's the first point. There are big negative externalities. Secondly, contrary to what you might think, consumerism, in fact, does not make people happy. People pursue consumerism, but the evidence is that above a certain level, further consumption just doesn't improve life happiness. And if what we really care about is what makes people feel good about themselves, what makes people happy, well, maybe there's something a little cockeyed about consumerism as a way of life. And finally, and ultimately, I think this is really the most important issue, the free market defense of consumerism assumes that people freely make the choice to live a consumerist lifestyle versus other lifestyles, that this is somehow an autonomous preference that just simply emerges in people and reflects a fact of almost human nature. People want more and more stuff. Well, the argument then is that there are systematic biases in the system which generate consumerism. And the claim, which I agree is a controversial claim, but the claim then is, if these biases were eliminated, many, and perhaps even most, people would adopt a less consumerist lifestyle. Consumerism isn't simply an autonomous, freely developed and chosen preference about how to live your life. It's a cultivated preference that reflects significant biases in the way the system works. And that means that we might prefer a world in which those biases were eliminated, so that to be a consumerist would be then just a taste, just a personal choice, rather than something that people are pressured into. Okay, we have these three basic arguments as to why consumerism is a problem. Let's look at each of them in turn. So first, negative externalities. Now, if I was actually here in person, talking to you in person, what I would now say to everybody is, okay, we've talked about negative externalities in a number of different contexts. We've discussed it as an abstract idea and then looked at it particularly in the context of transportation on Tuesday and the environment last week. What are some negative externalities of consumerism? Turn to the person next to you for 2 minutes and talk it over, and then we'll have a back and forth. Well, alas, I'm not here, and I figured I was imposing a lot on the TAs to have them run this class in my absence anyway. So I will just tell you a little bit about what I think are some of the negative externalities of consumerism. First, and most obviously, because we've already talked about this, hyper-consumerism, the endless pursuit of stuff, of more consumption, of shopping, hyper-consumerism has negative externalities on the environment, especially for future generations. Especially for future generations. The endless consumption of stuff by an ever-growing global population, so this is not just a problem for the United States, causes problems for the environment. Just think about landfills and toxic wastes and the depletion of certain kinds of resources. So as we said in the discussion of the environment, even if global warming was a non-issue, even if it was not the case that burning up oil risked environmental catastrophe, nevertheless, there's a finite amount of oil in the earth, and oil is, petroleum is useful for all sorts of products, and if we use it up now, we're creating negative externalities for future generations. We are depleting resources and thus are increasing costs for future generations. And many other aspects of consumerism one can see without a whole lot of additional thought. You can see how consumerism creates negative externalities for the environment. We can't simply have an endless growth of how much we consume and expect to reproduce in a stable way, in a sustainable way, as environmentalists like to say, the natural environment in which we live. And we certainly can't do that if we take a view about environmental and consumerist justice, if you will, and say, well, if we consume at this level, we should be perfectly happy with other countries and countries in the developing world to aspire to consume at the same level. It's just not on as a viable way of organizing our planet, especially for future generations. That's negative externalities. Secondly, that's an environmental negative externality. Secondly, there's a kind of negative externality that comes from certain very specific forms of consumption. Consider, for example, buying large cars, SUVs. Well, there's a kind of arms race on the highways. If you want to live modestly and only have a lightweight small car, you're concerned about the environment, and so you do so, you put your life at risk in a world where everybody else are driving tanks down the road. Not to mention if you're a cyclist like I am, although it was fortunate in my particular case that I was hit by a small car that was low slung, so I bounced up on the hood. If I had been hit by a large, fancy, heavy SUV, I might have suffered much worse than just a broken leg. Well, there are negative externalities that are imposed on other people by buying bigger and bigger cars. The house size problem that we saw, urban sprawl. Cities are much easier to organize in ways that are efficient and improve the quality of life for people when they are organized in a high density way. The consumerist desire, which is fueled also by developers' desire for higher profits, of building large houses with huge lawns in suburban areas, this creates the negative externality of urban sprawl. So that's negative externalities. I think if you want to kind of encapsulate that idea and really focus on what's most crucial about that idea, it's really the environmental externalities of consumerism. The second issue was happiness. What's the relationship between how much we consume and happiness? Well, there's some very good research on this now, done by psychologists and social psychologists especially, that attempt to map the relationship between how much you earn, what your annual income is, and how happy you are. Now, how much you earn isn't exactly the same as how much you consume, because you can earn a lot and you can save a lot, or you can give it away. You know, if you can earn $1 million and give away 800,000, and so your actual consumption level could be much lower. But nevertheless, I think for most people, most of what they earn is turned into consumption until you get into very high levels of income where people have lots and lots of excess income beyond even what they want to spend. What this chart shows is the percent of people surveyed in a fairly large survey who report certain kinds of states the previous day. So one way that you measure happiness is not asking somebody the question, how happy are you in general? You ask a more specific question. They ask three questions. Did you experience happiness, enjoyment, smiling, laughter yesterday? Did you not experience worry or sadness yesterday? Did you not feel stressed out yesterday? Make lots of criticisms of those questions. The basic idea is that if you have a large population, you'll get some sense, some pretty good indicator of the intensity of happy or unhappy or stressed or relaxed feelings in that population by asking these questions, even if a very happy person could have had a stressed out day the day before, right? So in this large survey, they asked people those questions, and they also asked what their income was. Now, if income and happiness were very tightly connected, you would have a straight line of increasing satisfaction with respect to these three questions as income increased. And indeed, we kind of see that for incomes going from very low to sort of middle level income around the median, the middle of the population. You can see on this graph that for all three of these indicators, happiness as measured by these three questions, in this particular study, happiness does increase pretty steadily from $10,000 or less annual income to over $40,000 annual income. But look what happens when you hit about $75,000. That's what the researchers in this study felt was the kind of key point where things flatten out. Once you earn about $75,000, from then on, even more income doesn't do much for happiness. Doesn't do much for these three forms of satisfaction. Something's going on here. People get satiated. The happiness boost from having enough to live comfortably and to feel secure, the additional happiness boost from having more and more consumption just doesn't seem to be very big. Okay, that's one bit of data. Money and happiness are connected, but only up to the kind of middling level. So a hyper-consumerist society, one that makes people feel that what they need to do is to consume more and more, does not mean that as they consume more and more, above a certain level, their happiness increases. Well, what does seem to increase when you ask people, how well is your life going as income increases, is something a little different from happiness. People were asked the following question: how satisfied are you with your life? 0 is the worst possible life for you, 10 is the best possible life. Now that does seem to keep going up as your income goes up. That's an interesting thing. You're not more happy, but you think your life is going better. What's going on here? Well, this seems to reflect, again, this is the argument of the people who did this study, that as you're, what happens when you're answering the question how well your life is going is you're comparing yourself to other people. And as your income goes up, there are more people whose lives are not as going as well as yours as measured by income. So if we take income as an indicator of your status in society, the higher the income, the more you think your life is going really well, because it's an indicator that your life is going better than other people. That's not the same as happiness, which is an internal state. If I ask you how happy you are, you're not saying, am I happier than somebody else? No, you're asking, how do you feel? What's your inner state of life? If I ask, are you stressed out? You're reporting something about how you're feeling inside. You're not saying, oh, I'm not stressed out because everybody else is more stressed out. No, if you feel stressed out, you feel stressed out, even if everybody else feels, or many people feel more stressed out. So happiness, stressed out, enjoying things, laughing yesterday. Well, laughing certainly is not, did I laugh more than other people? Did I laugh yesterday? So those questions in the previous are just asking about your inner state, whereas this question is really asking about how do you compare yourself to others? And that's an interesting thing about consumerism and about the money that underlies consumerism, is that it's grounded in comparative judgment. It's rooted in how you think about your relationship to other people, or what sociologists would call status. Okay, that's the second theme. The first was consumerism produces negative externalities. That's something to worry about. The second is that consumerism doesn't generate happiness. That certainly means that there's something maybe a little suspect about consumerism. The third issue is a series of system biases. And as I said, I think this is really the main point that I want to stress. This is really more central to the critique of consumerism, and that is that it isn't simply a individual, freely chosen way of life, but rather there's all sorts of biases in the way the system as a whole works, the way our economy works, that pressures people into consumerism. And the first theme along these lines is what can be called market failures in leisure. Market failures in leisure. The idea behind that is that it's actually not possible for people to just sit down and say, how much do I want to work? How much do I want to earn? And how much leisure do I want to have? And freely choose among those options. To freely choose among those options, one way of thinking about it is that there would be a real market in leisure. You could just seek out the kind of jobs that would give you the trade-off that seemed reasonable to you. Well, that just isn't a very reasonable description about how things work. So look at this graph. This graph shows the number of hours more per year on average that Americans work than people in other countries. This is just an empirical fact. How many more hours a week, a year, do Americans work? If we don't have a good market in leisure, you would think that but other countries might have a better set of options around leisure. You'd expect that Americans would work an awful lot longer than other people. Well, that's in fact the case. On average, Americans work 9.8 weeks longer a year. That's 40-hour. We're taking a 40-hour work week as our definition of a week here. 9.8, that's more than 2 months more of leisure time that the average German worker has compared to the average American worker. Even in the United Kingdom, it's 3.4 weeks. That's close to a month more of free time a year. Japan is the only country in which the average person in the labor market, in the labor force, only has a little bit more leisure than we do in the United States. Here's an interesting graph that's based on questions that are asked, that were asked people. People were asked, how much of future pay raises would you give up for future leisure? So you're earning what you're earning now, and you're going to get, you have the possibility of getting pay raises in the future. And would you, if you could freely make the choice, would you give up the pay raise, keep your pay the way it is, and instead of getting a pay raise, get more free time? So at one extreme, somebody would say, no, I'm not going to give up any pay raise. I'd rather have any pay raise rather than more free time. So if I'm getting a 10% pay raise, I would rather have that than 10% more free time. But close to 50% of the population in this study, this is a study done in the 1990s, I believe. It's a bit out of date, but I imagine that the results are pretty similar. Almost 50% of people say they would give up 100% of their pay raise for the comparable reduction of work hours. That means if you were offered a pay raise of 20% or a time reduction of 20% with the same salary, rather than having more income but more leisure, almost half of the population would opt for more leisure all the time rather than more pay. The next chart shows the amount of mandated paid vacation and paid holidays by law in rich countries in 2013. That the law requires paid vacations and paid holidays for people. So a paid Christmas day would be a paid holiday, and a summer vacation would be a paid vacation day. Well, the United States is really extreme in this case. Zero. No paid holidays required by law, and no paid vacations. And that compares to France, where there are 30 days of paid vacation per year, and most other countries where there are at least around 20 days of paid vacations plus additional days of paid holidays. And this final graph in this series shows the average actual weeks of paid vacation on average for full-time workers. In the United States, even though it's not required by law, many firms do give paid vacations to full-time workers. In the United States, the average actual weeks of paid vacation for full-time workers a year is under 4 weeks a year. In most other countries, it's 6 to 8 weeks a year. We work more hours a year with fewer paid vacations and paid holidays, and actually longer work days as well, than any other developed country. Now, it could be, you know, as one might imagine, that this is just Americans' preference. We just love to work. We're workaholics. That's what we like. It's kind of, it would be kind of an irony that we love to work and we also love to spend. It's a kind of weird situation. We spend a lot but don't have time to enjoy the things we spend money on. So the question is, why do we get these patterns? Now remember, I said that there's a system bias against leisure. Well, how should we understand the system bias against leisure? For a variety of reasons, it is very difficult for people to choose leisure over this pattern of working long hours and spending a lot of money. First, there are two kinds of optimal employment patterns for employers. If employers could just determine the world as they like. First, they want very flexible short hours of work that's completely under the control of the employer. This is good for a variety of relatively unskilled labor, where one person's labor and another person's labor are virtually indistinguishable. This can be termed involuntary underemployment, forced part-time labor with erratic schedules at the discretion of the employer, high flexibility with short hours at the employer's discretion. That's one kind of laboring situation, especially for unskilled labor in which the particular person who does the work doesn't matter, that employers would like. But the other situation which employers like is employer-controlled long hours of work, where the employer can require overtime, mandatory overtime of employees. And this applies to many kinds of jobs with very skilled workers. Employers prefer longer hours with fewer workers because it's often cheaper than hiring more workers for fewer hours because of fixed fringe benefits, because of training costs, because of all sorts of things. This is involuntary overemployment. The result is people can't choose flexible work with fewer hours without paying huge pay penalties. So one of the reasons why we have this kind of inflexibility with long hours and an inability for people to simply choose the balance between work and leisure is because of the preferences of employers. If you're skilled, employers want to be able to force you to work overtime. If you're unskilled, they want to have you available at their discretion for shorter work hours. A second issue is weak unions and weak labor market regulations, which prevent more collective regulation of the work-leisure balance. Wherever unions are strong in the world, they want and struggle for shorter hours and longer vacations. They want paid vacations. It was the struggle of labor unions that basically brought us the weekend. You know, we take a weekend for granted that the regular work week is 5 days a week. Well, it didn't used to be just 5 days a week. The regular work week used to be 6 or 6.5 days a week. It was an achievement of collective action by the labor movement in developed and developing capitalist countries to push the work week down to 40 hours and to preserve the weekend. And that's another reason why we have an inability of people to more freely choose how much they want to work, the relationship between work and leisure, a failure in a provision of a labor market and leisure. It's because we have weak unions in the United States. As I've already pointed out, the weakness of the legal provision of leisure time in the form of paid vacations, this is also the result of the lack of a political capacity on the part of ordinary working people to determine the conditions of their own employment. Long vacations and paid vacations and shorter work weeks, these are achievements. And as I noted in the slides, the result is that U.S. workers work on average about 1,800 hours a year, which is 300 or 400 hours more than the average European. That's not because the average European is lazy and we're industrious. No, it's because a different balance between work and leisure has been won by the collective action of people who have engaged in political action in order to counteract this market failure in the provision of leisure time. Here's a nice call it a thought experiment. Juliet Shore, who wrote this wonderful pair of books, The Overworked American and The Overspent American. She's a kind of consumer sociologist and economist. She wrote these important books around which much of the argument which I'm presenting is based. Well, she did the following kind of calculation. Suppose all of the productivity gains since 1960 had gone into reductions of work time rather than increases in consumption. Right, so productivity is just labor productivity is how much time does it take to produce a given quantity of output. And as productivity goes up, you have a choice. You can produce the same amount of output but spend less time doing it, or you can spend the same amount of time at work and produce more output. If you double productivity, you can double what you produce, or you can produce the same amount of stuff but just spend half the amount of time. So how many hours a week would the average person have to work in the United States today, 50 plus years since 1960, if all productivity gains had gone into the reductions in the work week? Now, if that had happened, we would have an average standard of living at about the level of 1960. That is, people's consumption standards would be about the same as they were in 1960. And after all, in 1960, the standard of living of people in the United States, how much they consumed, was the highest level in the world and the highest level in world history. So it wasn't that bad in 1960. Indeed, people often nostalgically look back to the 1950s and 60s as a kind of golden age in which the levels of consumption of people are part of that vision of what was so great about that period. Well, if all productivity gains since 1960 had gone into reductions of the work week, the average work week today would be about 15 hours. And here's the irony. If you ask people today, would you rather keep your current income and work half as many hours, or work the same hours and double your income? Most people would say, I would rather keep my income and work half as many hours, rather than earn twice as much and work just as hard. If 20 years later, when their income had doubled, you ask them, would you rather keep your present income and work hours or work half as many hours with half the income? Most people would say, I would rather keep my present income and the number of hours I work. In effect, what happens is, if you turn productivity into increasing income, people become habituated to that higher level of consumption and then regard a reduction of that income as a big sacrifice. So what people want when they think about moving from now into the future is different from what they want in the future when they are asked the same question, in a sense, retrospectively. People readjust their expectations to what counts as an acceptable level of consumption based on how much they're actually consuming. So I suspect for most of you, if you asked your parents, Mom, Dad, if you could keep your present income, earn just exactly what you earn now, and work half as many hours a week, would you choose that, or would you prefer to work the same number of hours a week as you're earning now, working now, and earn twice as much? You could have twice as much free time as you have now, or twice as much income, but the same amount of free time. I suspect that many, maybe most, I don't know, you can try this as an experiment, I suspect that many of your parents would say, God, it would be great if I could work half as much and earn and live the same way I live now. The fact that they can't make these choices over time because of the dynamics of the economy and the nature of the structures and the rigidities in the system, that reflects a market failure in leisure. So that's the first system bias. The second system bias. Second system bias, consumption bias, comes from profit-maximizing strategies and consumerist culture. Profit-maximizing strategies and consumerist culture. Capitalist firms make their profits from selling stuff. The more people buy, the better off they are. Capitalists compete with each other, and the competition leads each capitalist to try to sell more. No capitalist says, my goal is to sell half as much in the next 20 years. No, each capitalist firm, in order to maximize their profits, wants to increase the sale of what they produce. Suppose that a voluntary simplicity anti-consumerist movement gains strength, and that masses of Americans said, enough is enough. I want to live a simple lifestyle and consume less and enjoy more free time. What would happen if that movement actually got enough steam so that large numbers of people opted out of a consumerist culture? What would happen? Lots of firms would go broke. A lot of firms would go bankrupt. Consumer demand would fall. And this would hurt everyone. Would actually hurt the people who opted for the voluntary simplicity, given the rules of the game under which our economy works, because it would increase unemployment. And unemployment means you don't have a job and you don't have income to even live in voluntary simplicity. That was, just think about the Great Recession when you were younger, 8 years ago. Nobody, no politician stood up and said, this is great, consumption has declined, we can now readjust to a simpler lifestyle. No, one of the recommendations was, everyone, go out and shop, spend more, this will help the economy. This is the problem then. Think of it this way, from the point of view of profits, if you double your productivity, which is better, doubling leisure time and keeping consumption levels constant, or double consumption levels? You know, you're a profit-making firm and you're just saying, what's going to be the best for my firm? I'm going to double productivity? Should we double the sales of our products or should we double the amount of free time? From the point of view of capitalist firms and profits, the second is clearly preferable. And this is why capitalist firms devote so much to advertising. Now, look at this next slide. This is a slide that shows the annual exposure of children, teens, and adults to advertising. The annual exposure to ads on, I believe these are television ads. I think this chart is in the book, so you'd have to confirm that. I believe this is a study of television ads. It's divided into food ads, non-food ads, and various kinds of public service announcements and promotional ads. So for children, the average child is exposed in a year to roughly 1 week of advertising, 30,000 hours of ads. Is that minutes or, you know, on the chart it doesn't say what the units are. 30,000 hours is more than a week's worth of hours, so it must be minutes of ads. The average adult is exposed to 2 weeks worth of advertising on television per year. 2 weeks. You know, that's 1/25th of their life is spent watching ads. Capitalists spend a huge amount of resources in advertisements, which means they're spending a lot of resources in trying to get you to buy things. Well, what, in fact, are commercials? What, in fact, are advertisements? There are two kinds of ways you could think about it. As you know, I like to say there's two of everything, right? Two kinds of ways. One is that advertisement merely provides information, and it therefore reinforces consumer sovereignty, right? So consumer sovereignty, consumers are in power, requires that consumers have good information. And what commercial advertising does is gives consumer the necessary information to make wise choices. Well, I mean, who actually believes that? That that's the main thing that advertising does, is provide you good information. The other view is that advertising shapes shared desires and dissatisfactions. That advertisement shapes dissatisfactions is as important as it shapes desires. Advertising tells you that the products you're consuming are out of date, that they're not as good as they could be, and that other people are enjoying a better product. The annual display of new smartphones is meant to convey that, oh, I'm out of date. My smartphone is no longer going to give me pleasure. You were so excited about it 2 years ago when you got it. It seemed just the thing to have. It gave you pleasure. And now it doesn't, not because any deterioration in the functionality of your smartphone, but because a slicker, better smartphone has been advertised and thrown in your face. It makes you dissatisfied with what you have to consume. What's really important here is that consumer preferences are not formed in an autonomous way. Desires are shaped and shared. That's what's important, that the desires you have become desires because they're held in common with other people. This is what it means to say that advertising shapes culture. It doesn't just provide information, it shapes culture. It shapes the shared understanding among people about what's desirable. This means that consumer understands what other people think of them by virtue of what they themselves consume. That's the message that advertising does. It makes you feel that the next time you pull out your old smartphone, other people are going to look at you and say, aha, that's a person with an old smartphone. And that creates pressure to upgrade, even though the existing smartphone is serving all the real needs that you have to communicate with the world. Capitalism needs growth, rooted in the continual expansion of markets in order to maximize profits. And so capitalist firms put enormous resources into shaping consumerist culture. This creates tremendous biases in favor of consumption over leisure, unless there are constraints imposed on those pressures. That's the second system bias. The third system bias: changing reference groups for consumption norms. Now this gets to a really interesting, hardcore, very traditional sociological idea. So this is kind of one of these points that's kind of basic sociology, the idea of a reference group. This is really a nice sociological idea and something that you can carry around with you in your back pocket for all sorts of circumstances. It refers to the types of people who define the standards in terms of which one evaluates how well one is doing. Your reference group are the sorts of people you look to figure out, am I doing well or not? Are things okay or not? Among teenagers, this is very important in terms of such things as school achievement. Here the term is often used, that's often used as peer group and peer group pressures. A bright student who is part of a reference group or peer group in which academic achievement is seen as uncool is much more likely to do badly in school than an equally bright kid who's part of an academically oriented peer group. And this is why parents often worry about what your peer group is, right? I'm sure you all had this experience growing up. Maybe some of you had such wonderful peer groups that your parents never worried about it. But parents do worry about the peer groups of their children. And the reason is that peer groups can be very powerful in shaping the kind of person a teenager becomes, because it shapes the standards by which one tries to live one's life. Well, a consumption reference group is a particular kind of reference group. It refers to the category of people with whom one compares oneself in order to figure out how well one is doing with respect to that issue, consumption. Most people do not compare themselves to Donald Trump and say, I'm doing badly because I don't live as well as that. So Donald Trump is in the stratosphere, and most people either like it or hate it. There's different responses to that. But they're not really comparing themselves. They don't say, unless I do that well, I'm a failure. The question then is, what are the standards of living that people use to define doing well, and has this changed? In stable communities, when the way people used to live, with a stable community where relatively few people would leave and go elsewhere, the reference group were largely people pretty much like oneself. The expression, keeping up with the Joneses, you know, I think this is probably still a familiar expression. That was an expression from an earlier era where the Joneses were meant to be your neighbor. And keeping up with the Joneses meant when your neighbor bought a new car, you felt you needed to buy a new car to keep up with the Joneses. That's changed. And one of the reasons it's changed is that people's sense of what the average family is like has ratcheted up the income scale. And some people think that this is largely due to television. It's no longer keeping up with the Joneses, but keeping up with the consumption standard one observes on television. According to Juliet Shore, the average sitcom and TV drama portray standards of living around the top 25% or so. So the typical family with the sorts of furniture and accoutrements in their apartments that you see when you just watch a bunch of stuff on television, the typical family lives somewhere around the top 25%. And that's what's seen as kind of normal, as what's average. And thus people feel that they're not doing well unless they live like that. Here's a particularly poignant aspect of this ratcheting up of consumption norms, of the consumption reference group in terms of which people compare themselves. And it centers around the costs of getting married. Marriages, the average marriage today is vastly more expensive than 50 years ago. And there's changing norms that go all the way down the income ladder as to what defines a respectable marriage. Wedding. How much of a do does it have to be? How much do you have to spend on it? How big an affair is it? This escalation in the cost of wedding has been driven by the marriage industry. This isn't just a spontaneous escalation in the cost of marriage just coming from a change in people's preferences. No, there's a marriage industry which makes its money by selling marriage extravaganzas. This has had the result, at least some sociologists argue, of reducing the marriage rate among poor people. One of the reasons why poor people don't get married, more people cohabit without getting married, one of the reasons for the low marriage rate is the costs of getting married. Now, the cost of going down to City Hall and just getting married by a clerk, the court in City Hall, that hasn't changed, but that's not seen as a proper wedding. What are the results of this ratcheting up in the reference group for consumption? First, there's a huge consumption gap between what people can actually afford and what they feel they should consume. Should is a cultural ideal. It's a cultural standard rooted in shared understandings. It's not just should because of what I personally think. It should because of what in my environment people in common think. This isn't just envy. I mean, that's important. Envy is a kind of put down of people aspiring to consume more than they can. They're envious of people who earn more. No, this is different. This has to do with identity and with a sense of what it means to be worthy. And as a result of this, people go into much more debt in order to live up to their ideals about what they should consume. There's an extraordinary rise in consumer debt over the last quarter of a century, especially in the past 15, 20, 30 years. Well, I said quarter of a century, in the last decades. And this brings us to the fourth system bias, credit cards. Credit cards to the rescue. If we live in a world where people want to consume much more than they can afford, what's a nice way to take advantage of this? Make it easy for people to borrow and charge them big interest rates on the borrowing. here's the basic facts. And this is discussed in detail in the book. The basic fact, a huge expansion of credit card debt in the United States. This is historically novel. It's a novel phenomenon that the vast majority of people who are in low or middling levels of the income structure have huge amounts of consumer debt. It is part of what people call the financialization of the American economy. Many companies make much more money out of loaning money for people to buy their products than they do out of the products themselves. General Motors, for example, makes more money from lending money to buy their cars than they do from making the cars themselves. We'll look at this in detail next week when we discuss finance as a sector of the American economy. There's aggressive advertising and promotion of credit cards by credit card companies. It's not just that people go out and get them. They get inundated with offers of credit cards. Here's some basic data, by the way. It's on the overhead. Consumer debt grew from just under $900 billion in 1980 to $2.4 trillion in 2011. The average credit card balance for families with a balance grew from $3,300 in 1989 to over $7,000 in 2010 in constant inflation-adjusted dollars. And U.S. households receive a total of 7 billion credit card solicitations a year. The total number of solicitations in the United States in 2006 was 7 billion. Just before the Great Recession, this declined to a mere 2.6 billion in 2012. Credit cards are a key part of the expansion of consumer debt. And this is a key way of fueling consumerism, which is underwritten by this gap between what people can afford and what people think they ought to spend, how much they ought to consume. Fifth, system bias. Increasing inequality ratchets up consumption demands. This is the problem of what is called positional goods. Positional goods. Now, this is a really interesting issue, one which, like many of the things we're talking about, once you understand what a positional good is, you'll see them all over the place. What do we mean by this? How much you need to consume is in part a function of what people above you consume. Sometimes this is a status issue. So sometimes it's really about identity, about how you think about yourself. Here's an example. Robert Frank, an economist who writes about these things in quite interesting ways, Robert Frank gives the following example. Suppose you had a choice between two worlds. You live in a house of 4,000 square feet, and everyone else has 6,000 square feet. Or you live in a house of 3,000 square feet and everyone else has 2,000 square feet. Which would you prefer? Well, if all you cared about was how much room you had, you'd prefer to live in a 4,000 square foot house in a world where that was the smallest house available and everybody else had a bigger house. In fact, people would rather live in a smaller house that was bigger than others. That's status consumption. That means you prefer, what you prefer to consume depends upon what other people consume. Not just by in terms of what you get out of it, but by the status you get out of consuming what you consume. But that's not the only issue. And I think even aside from status consumption, there are pressures generated on people to consume more because other people consume more. Here's an example. An important example. One's access to good schools for one's children depends upon the neighborhood in which one lives. And since the increase in very high incomes in the top 20% generates more inequality in neighborhoods, we've had a great increase in income inequality, and that's generated more inequality in the costs of different neighborhoods, a person may have to escalate their consumption to move to a too expensive neighborhood for their earnings in order to satisfy this real need, that is, to get your children into the best possible schools. Middle-class people, therefore, have to buy bigger houses and take on bigger mortgages now just to sustain their relative position. It's not because they want to move up in the world. It's they want to just maintain their position. But in order to maintain their position, because the quality of schooling depends upon the cost of the neighborhood, if inequalities in neighborhood goes up, they have to attempt to spend a higher proportion of their income on housing to move up to a better neighborhood. This is similar to the what I mentioned before, the arms race in big cars. The safety of your car depends upon the size of other people's cars, not just your own car. So if some people buy SUVs, then smaller cars become less safe, and pressure increases on you to buy an SUV, not because you want a bigger car, but because you don't want a car that's at risk of being smashed to pieces by the presence of so many big cars on the road. That is a system bias in which the increasing inequality of earnings in the economy, which enables more people at the top to buy these positional goods, forces other people to ratchet up their consumption in order to maintain their position in the same place. In order to be as safe as you were before on the highway, you have to spend more money on a car. Finally, the fifth system bias centers around the decline of public goods and the abandonment of public consumption by affluent people. The erosion of public goods. Remember, public goods are goods that are provided for everybody, that everybody can consume, and they're provided by the public. That's the loose definition of public goods that we've been working with. The erosion of public goods leads to less efficient consumption of private goods. Let's look at private schools. If the affluent send their children to private schools rather than support tax increases to improve the quality or maintain the quality of public schools, this leads to a deterioration of public schools, which makes private schools more attractive. The affluent leave public schools. They no longer support taxes for public schools. Private schools become more attractive because of a deterioration of public schools. Gated communities become more attractive because of the deterioration of policing and public safety. Private swimming clubs and private pools become more attractive because of the deterioration of public recreation facilities. This generates a vicious cycle. As the more affluent pull out of public schools, out of public goods consumption, like public schools, they reduce their political support for the provision of those public goods. And because they have political clout, the removal of their political support for the provision of those public goods undermines the willingness to raise taxes to pay for them. This leads to further deterioration of the public goods, which leads more people to prefer private consumption over public goods. But the private consumptions are more costly. It's less efficient. It's way less efficient for people to have private swimming pools than to have good public swimming pools available for all. So the conclusion is that given all of these pressures in the system, all of these biases that we've been reviewing, the biases of the market failures in leisure, the bias of profit-maximizing strategies in consumerist cultures where profit-maximizing firms want to maximize consumption, want to push people in a consumerist direction, the bias of changing reference groups where people's beliefs about what they should consume just to maintain their sense of self-respect outstretches their ability to consume, and that consumption gap drives credit cards, the fourth system bias, which makes it, in a sense, too easy for people to borrow in order to ratchet up their consumption, and thus reproduce these higher consumption norms. And the ways in which rising inequality increases consumerism by strengthening the role of positional goods and forcing people to consume more in order to just stay put within the distribution. And finally, the erosion of public provision of public consumption and the substitution by private consumption. All of this makes it very difficult that a more balanced pattern of consumption will spontaneously emerge just from private, uncoordinated activity. That is, the free market logic says, well, if this is a problem, the market will solve it. People will solve this problem just by their individual choices. Well, given all these biases in the system, it's extremely unlikely that a less consumerist society with a more balanced life between consumption and leisure will simply emerge from private, uncoordinated activity. Once again, there needs to be some kind of public coordination to create conditions for a less hyper-consumption economy. And this requires, as I've said with respect to the environment and transportation, and we'll see with respect to other issues we discuss, requires a democratically accountable affirmative state that regulates these market pressures and acts as a counterweight to them, rather than a state that withdraws from interference in the market and lets it do the work of shaping our preferences. Well, thanks very much, and I will be back on Tuesday in the flesh, not just on a video. See you then.
Great.
Well, that was...